Accession number 10420, rule 16.
Colonel W.I. Watson, reel 16.
Both these old gentlemen were slightly annoyed, I think, that they had not got the commanding officer billeted on them. With them from time to time came General Sir Travers and Lady Clark, who was then the quartermaster general in London. They sometimes brought their daughter with them. They were veritable, he was a veritable know-all, and I lived in this house, or was billeted in this house, which was a large house in its own grounds of some considerable size, chiefly parkland with very little gardens. And I slept in a feather bed, and these two old men at night used to sit in front of the billiard room fire with their feet up on a cushion, on a chair, and one of them always wore a little black cap. Now, I only dined there twice, but on one occasion I dined there when the Travers Clark family were there, and the ladies, daughter, Lady Clark and the her daughter, went to the drawing room, and these old two old men, with Sir Travers, went to the billiard room, and smoked their pipes, and had their port. And when the time came to go to bed, they doused the fire and retired up to their respective bedrooms. But the Lady Clark would come in and signify that it was time for that ceremony to take place. It really was an extraordinarily old-fashioned house. And As I mentioned, I only had two meals there the whole of the time I was there. But I did ask one occasion if I could stay in bed after I'd been inoculated, as it made me feel so rotten for a day or two. And they permitted that. And I think one of the maids actually brought me an egg for breakfast. But otherwise, I only had two meals there, and both were prior to going overseas. There was a false alarm, you might say. Our embarkation was cancelled, so I got a meal there, and I had a meal the day before I finally left for the Middle East. They were really incredibly mean, but and all they knew really about what was going on was from the papers, and the life beyond the village didn't interest them at all. I often wonder now to this day who lives there. I have been back, but I could never find out. Some years ago, my wife and I went back, but the house was right out of the village at the very end of Ufton, which is a long, straggly village. Well, by the end of November, I was embroiled once more with the Home Guard, and I met on a commander and Mrs. Adams, and I went to their lovely house for a lunch. She had been the wife of the of the local MP, and he died, and she'd married Commander Edward, who I think I'm right in saying was an old boy of my prep school. I have a feeling he was an old boy of Asgarth School, but I really can't be absolutely absolutely certain. I tried to help the Home Guard, and I think they were very enthusiastic, more enthusiastic to work with us. Adams is the commander, Commander Adams. I think they were more enthusiastic to work with us than they had been to the King's Own Scottish Borderers, who had not helped them at all. And we tried to be start off from right from scratch, as it were, with them. There was there was a Columpton battalion. There was another which covered the area Bradninch to the outskirts of Exeter to Hemiock, and there was Comstock on the northeast, and there was Holberton, Samford, Peveril on the southwest, and Ufcombe and Kentispear, I think it is, on the southeast. And that was our area of the battalion which we had to help. And most of the time we did map reading and exercises, and I dined with Commander and Mrs. Adams a number of occasions at Bradfield, and we did all we could to help them. We were told then that our general, Martel, divisional commander, was to leave us, and he left, and he went to command the Royal Armoured Corps.
What was your final opinion of him after being with him all this time?
Martel, he was much more a mechanic, really. His mind was really on the tanks the whole time, and he was a tank specialist, and I don't think he was really an good infantry commander, but of course he had to know everything in the division, all arms, but primarily he should have been an infantry commander. I think his mind was always on the tank, and those armored cars, heavyweight armored cars, his mind was there. Were they any good? Were they useless? And well, he found out that they were quite useless. That, I think, was really at the back of his mind, but he was devoted to his division. There is absolutely no doubt. The 50th Division was where the blue-eyed boys, and he'd been so long with them now. Anyhow, he was succeeded by General Ramsden. By the end of, about the middle of November, I suppose it was, we got the news that, definite news, that we were to mobilize completely by the end of January, and embarkation leave had to be finished by the 21st of January 1941.
How long was an embarkation leave?
Fortnight, I think it was. I think, or a week only, I'm not quite sure. I'd have to look it up. We did various exercises. I remember on one occasion we did a night attack, and I was again umpiring, and I recollect that it was very moonlight, and the carriers were particularly noisy, and so were the chaps. It was when there should have been absolute silence, there was a good deal of noise, and too much interest paid by the officers onto the flanks rather than what was ahead.
Were these exercises still very much of a defensive character?
Oh, yes.
In terms of invasion?
Yes, they were much more of, still of a, well, they were more, not quite so defensive, because we were in a reserve area there, and we might be pushed anywhere. But we did have exercises, and of all sorts, really, I think. But they were defensive, because on one occasion, which I can mention, we were told to stop an Italian invasion, possibly on the Libyan coast, and we did it on the North Devonshire coast. That sort of thing. Anyhow, halfway through December, one Sunday afternoon, General Ramsden came to see the battalion, and he asked the brigadier if I was going to the senior officer school. I remember the brigadier saying yes, but I'm sure he just made it up at the moment, and to satisfy General Ramsden. General Ramsden was known as Gambo Screen, because he thought the screens used in the northwest frontier of India for signaling purposes, which flicked up and down and were of a gamboge colour, could well be used in the desert. The last thing you could use in the desert was a gamboge screen. But he was always known as the gamboge screen. Now, on the 19th of December that year, 1940, embarkation leave started. And I certainly didn't go on embarkation leave, but it started. And on Christmas Day, I went to church with Sammy Battiscombe. I went to church, certainly in African church, and you couldn't put lights on in the church because it was still dark if you went to early service at 8 o'clock. And you groped your way into the church and you suddenly found figures sitting in the pews in the dark until you could put your lights on. There were no blackout on the church windows, and it really was the most extraordinary performance and sensation going into the church, say at 7:30, 7:45, in pitch darkness, and groping your way down the aisle, and suddenly find another black figure sitting in the pews. And then I know on one occasion somebody turned the lights on, and right in the middle of the service, the parson said it's not time yet, and they had to be turned out again, and then turned on when it was time you could put them on. Anyhow, on Christmas morning I went to church, and then afterwards I went with Sammy Battiscombe to the home of Dr. and Mrs. Mars, who lived in Winsford on the borders of Exmoor. And there were staying Sammy Battiscombe's wife, Karen, and her daughter, and the Mars, and also a daughter of the Mars and her children. And they were Jews, and of course this was a Christian festival. And Mrs. Mars was very keen on hunting, and they couldn't have been kinder. They got Karen's mother and father from the billets that they were in Winsford, and we had a full Christmas festival, and they gave me as a Christmas present a pencil which you twisted round, and it had various colours on it, and I feel that the daughter, the Mars's daughter, had been converted to Christianity, because the children certainly were, her children certainly were. And I know too that Dr. Mars's best friend in the village was in fact the vicar, and that the two of them used to play billiards together. Now, the son, we had two. Ham for supper, which seemed rather extraordinary in a Jewish household. Now, the son, Eddie Mars, was already a serving soldier. I think he was a sapper, but he was abroad. And strange to say, after the war in the 60s or sometime in the 50s and 60s, he was living at Gilling, not far from here, and I met him frequently. I went to meals there, and they came to meals with me, my wife and myself here. And they had a daughter who was a very good pianist at the time. But that was the son of those two of that family who'd been so particularly kind to me on Christmas Day 1940. On the 30th, I started my embarkation leave, and with Eardley Wilmot, who was then the adjutant, and bearing in, we didn't leave till about midday on the 30th, and bearing in mind the lighting of one's car, I had a very nice Rover at the time, the journey was appalling, from right down from Devon to here in Barnard Castle. I took Eardley Wilmot because his father was the admiral in charge of the ports at Middlesbrough and I think Hartlepool, and I intended to, and did in fact, drop him off at Bancroft Station in Darlington when we eventually got there. I made him navigator, and we somehow got hopelessly wrong round Market Harbour and Melton Mowbray, but we eventually got to Doncaster on the A1, and I had was suffering an appalling headache. I really didn't want to drive any further, but it was pitch dark, of course, most of the time being in the dark with our pinhead headlights, and we asked a Dana motel in Doncaster if they could put us up for the night, and they said we wouldn't get a bed anywhere in Doncaster. And so we drove on, and we slept for an hour by the roadside north of Doncaster, and we drove on again, and we got completely lost once more, and we found ourselves in a town, and we didn't know where we were. And I thought perhaps the name of the town would be on the war memorial. You've got to remember now, there wasn't a road sign anywhere in the British Isles. It was simply guesswork, or trying to find your way by a map. But in the night, of course, it was well nigh impossible. And I thought perhaps the name of this town would be on the war memorial, to the glorious dead of. But not a bit of it. It was chiseled out. Happily, there was a pitman going to work at 1 o'clock in the morning, and we asked him where we were, and he told us we were in Pontefract, and he told us how to get on to the A1 again, which we duly did, and round about whether we stopped again for another sleep. And eventually, I dropped off Eardley Wilmot at Banktop Station in Darlington and came home for a few days' leave. I think it must have been a week. I think it was a week's leave, because I know on the 9th of January, I did a signal exercise, commanded the battalion on a signal exercise. So it must have been a week's leave we got. I came back by train, of course. I didn't come back in the car. I left the car here at home.
What were your feelings when you were told that you were imminently going abroad?
Well, I think we all looked forward to it. We thought now we're going to do something well worthwhile.
How did your parents receive you, knowing that you were going?
My mother was the only person alive. Of course, she was getting on in years, and she was in poor health. Undoubtedly, she worried. Undoubtedly, did, because my sister was abroad in Egypt with her husband in the Cheshire Regiment. I was going abroad. My younger brother was abroad in Africa, and subsequently came up the African Pioneer Corps into the Western Desert, and was very nearly taken prisoner. And of course, my middle brother had been wounded in Dunkirk, and I don't think he'd gone abroad, but eventually did go abroad shortly afterwards. So she was losing all.
She's losing the whole family.
The whole family. And my brother had been wounded before Dunkirk, and she was losing the whole family.
She must have left her feeling pretty lonely.
Pretty lonely. Of course, there were any number of people from time to time. Billy Titier in the house. She had soldiers and their wives, officers and their wives, billeted here, who were stationed in the camps. The camps here in Barnard Castle, when I left, was called up in August, there wasn't a brick built. There wasn't a brick anywhere. And then the host of camps all around the town. And she had the wives and sometimes various officers billeted here.
Did she have any permanent staff?
Yes, she had. She had two, I think. Then, certainly one was one very faithful one that helped her, but she was in poor health. Very poor health, really.
So the week that you were at home, what basically were you doing?
Basically, of course it was midwinter, deep. Deep winter. I was relaxing, really. If my mother wanted to go out, I took her. I can't remember who was billeted here at the time then. I do when I came back from the war remember who was billeted. Although the war was over then, but there were still a few people billeted. And the camps were still very full, but
were you getting at this time, now that you're earmarked to go abroad, were you beginning to get any forms of lectures to prepare you for the?
No. But what we did do was, as I can mention, we began to get kitted out. The question came of khaki drill. And at the beginning of January, we had, I did particularly, because I was the senior, of the battalion, one of the original officers in the battalion. You see, we've got a Victor Yates, a CO, he was a regular battalion, and so was Samuel Battiscombe. And we had then, I had a really hearty row with the CO and the second in command over the black buttons. The CO said that we would just have the GS, General Service buttons, everybody would wear those. There'd be no question of the black buttons. The very precious traditions. And I don't know what I did actually say, but I was supported by the Regimental Armada, who said that the NCOs were certainly wanted to wear the black buttons, and so did we. And so Victor Yates, Samuel Battiscombe was indifferent, but the Victor Yates finally gave in, and the black buttons tradition prevailed. But it was unpleasant. I mean, no CO ought to said straight away, well, never mind about the black buttons. But the thereafter, we all got more black buttons, our traditional black buttons, and I had black buttons sent out by air from England to us out in the Middle East. Out in the Middle East, all the officers wore a particular kind of shirt, which was worn by the Green Jacket, the Rifle Brigade in the 60s, and we all had black shirt buttons. You took all the ordinary buttons off, and you could pin the black buttons on, and take them off when the shirt was washed. But I insisted that the old traditions must prevail, and we had a firm of Ross. Big tailors in Exeter. They made the khaki drill for the officers with the black buttons, and the NCOs on the khaki drill wore black chevrons with a red base, and we thereafter wore them until we were finally disbanded in 1968. I remember too, there was an inspection by the colonel, the CO, behind the old mill in Ufton on the 31st of January of my company and the headquarters, battalion headquarters, in khaki drill. Well, perishingly cold day, all these chaps dressed up in their khaki drill to see that the khaki drill fitted, and we were known then as the Pansy Division because we wanted payment for tailors to come and fit the chaps and the NCOs with their khaki drill, the Pansy Division. I always think the security wasn't at all good at that time because every battalion were issued with topies, and all the Women's Institute round that area of Devon sewed the flashes of that particular battalion on the topies.